David Beatty is a D.C. homeless resident.
I look at it as anti-Christian. I remember the passage of, as you have done unto the least of these, you have done unto me. And the idea that he's targeting us and persecuting us feels wrong to me.
I'm Christina Onnestad, reporting for Pacifica Radio.
Escuchando in Washington and all points beyond. This is Oscar Fernandez, and you're listening to Latino Media Collective here on WPFW 89.3 FM, Washington. El Distrito Colombia here on this Friday, August 15, 2025. We're also in the middle of WPFW Summer Pledge Drive, which gives you the opportunity to support the Latino Media Collective by going to WPFWFM.org to make a donation. You can also call 202-588-9739 or 1-800-222-9739. And if you have the Cash App on your phone, make a donation to $WPFWFM. And please give credit to the Latino Media Collective when you do so. We need your support for independent journalism during these creeping authoritarian times, especially here in the Washington area. So once again, this is Oscar Fernandez, and today on the show, we put the spotlight on our Muslim brothers and sisters in Western Sahara as the Sahrawi people continue their struggle for independence almost 50 years after Morocco invaded and occupied the small African nation. And so in order to do that today, we are joined today by Jacob Mundy, who's an assistant professor of peace and conflict studies at Colgate University in New York. Welcome back to the show, Jacob Mundy.
It's great to be with you.
We're also joined by Stephen Zunes, who's a professor of politics and coordinator of Middle Eastern Studies at the University of San Francisco. Together, they are co-authors of Western Sahara, War, Nationalism, and Conflict Irresolution. Stephen Zunes also has a recent article in Truthout entitled Bipartisan U.S. Push Tries to Label African Government as Terrorist. Welcome back to the show, Stephen Zunes.
Good to be with you again.
Absolutely. So I'm going to try to both summarize and quote your recent article in Truthout with the following quote: Morocco invaded Western Sahara in 1975. just prior to the territory's scheduled independence from Spain, in direct defiance of a landmark ruling by the International Court of Justice and series of United Nations resolutions. The Security Council unanimously called on Moroccan forces to immediately withdraw from the territory and allow the people of Western Sahara to determine their own destiny. However, both France and the United States, wanting to support the pro-Western king and wary of a leftist revolutionary movement coming to power, prevented the Security Council from enforcing its mandate. 50 years later, here we are having this conversation today. So let me begin with you, Stephen. In your recent article in Truth Out, a bipartisan resolution in the U.S. House of Representatives introduced by Joe Wilson and Jimmy Panetta targeting the Polisario Front, the government of Western Sahara, as a terrorist organization. While you state that this designation of armed groups as terrorist organizations has always been politicized by U.S. government, can you tell us how such a characterization of the Polisario Front does not meet the definition of the UN Security Council, among other things?
Well, first and foremost, the Polisario has never engaged in terrorism. I mean, not once. I mean, they've signed the Fourth Geneva Convention and various other international treaties regarding protecting the noncombatants in war. They have fought Moroccan occupation forces, not Moroccan civilians or any other civilians. So, you know, that's the most, you know, they have actually done pretty much everything right using the United Nations, the International Court of Justice, other international means, global civil society. It's ironic, and the U.S. says, oh, we cannot recognize a Palestinian state because the Palestinian resistance is divided. Some of them engage in terrorism. None of them are democratic. And, you know, some of them don't recognize Israel's right to exist. Well, you know, the Polisario, I mean, the Western Saharans are united, and that Polisario is their representative. They may not agree with every policy, but, you know, they see them as their representative government. They have democratic elections. As I mentioned, they never engage in terrorism. They don't question Morocco's right to exist. But despite that, the U.S. is hostile to them, or even more so than they are towards the Palestinians. So I think it demonstrates the U.S. is quite willing to support allies, invade, occupy, colonize, you know, their neighbors. We don't need an APAC for that. The U.S. is willing to support Morocco as well. And again, the terrorism charge is completely ludicrous. No other nation recognizes them as a terrorist group. And also as a full member state of the African Union, I mean, this would be unprecedented. The Western Sahara has been recognized at one time or another by over 80 countries. And so this would be the first time that, you know, an entire nation state has been, you know, in effect, been declared a terrorist organization.
Yeah, and I want to reiterate again what you mentioned in your article, that these sort of designations has always been politicized, because once upon a time, the Sandinistas in Nicaragua was considered a terrorist organization. Once upon a time in El Salvador, the FMLN was considered a terrorist organization by the United States. Even the ANC, the same ANC, you know, led by Nelson Mandela, was considered a terrorist organization. In one form or another, in present day and time, all these organizations are considered legitimate political parties. And so I bring this up because in an imperfect world, there's no such thing as a perfect resistance movement. Mm. And even if there was one that was following the rules, as you mentioned, you know, as the Polisario Front, the occupiers, you know, whether it be Morocco, and I'm sorry, but it's hard to avoid the comparisons with Palestine, you know, it seems very clear, especially with the numerous shows that we've done on this show with regards to Western Sahara, that Morocco has no interest in a peaceful resistance movement. And by the way, people who are under occupation are under no obligation to appease the occupiers themselves. So I bring this all up because in your Truth Out article, one of the things that fascinates me about your article is that I learn something new about Western Sahara every time I do an episode on it on this show, is that if you could tell us about the importance of 1982 with regards to how much gains they made during this time period and how that was eventually squashed by the United States among other forces as well during this time period.
Well, in the initial resistance to the Moroccan invasion in 1975, the armed wing of the Polisario Front, which had been fighting the Spaniards, were able to defeat the Mauritanians, who, you know, had occupied the southern third of the country. but also drove the Moroccans out about 85% of the territory. In 1982, it looked like victory was imminent. But then the United States and France, with some financial support from Saudi Arabia, dramatically increased military assistance to Morocco. U.S. Special Forces, the Green Berets, actually started operating in Western Sahara, direct training of Moroccan forces, moving from the slow, you know, mechanized units of conventional warfare to a more effective, smaller unit counterinsurgency, a kind of campaign, which eventually ended up in Morocco recovering a majority of the territory and building this giant separation barrier, which is basically these twin sand berms with landmines, barbed wire, and sentry posts, about 1,200 kilometers long, and keeping most of the, you know, the Polisario and roughly half of the Sahrawi population out of most of their own country.
Precisely. And again, I always learn something new whenever I do these episodes on Western Sahara. And during the 19 years that this show has been on WPFW, we've done not one, not two, but six episodes on Western Sahara as a means to raise awareness about what is otherwise a story of occupation that's been generally ignored. And I don't remember if it was you or Jacob who once told me that one of the greatest weapons against the Sahrawi people is silence. And that's certainly the case with the increased surveillance apparatus in Morocco. And so this brings me to Jacob, because in the fall of 2024, the magazine Marip released an important article by Samir Erazouki describing Morocco's growing security apparatus in both Western Sahara and on its own people. Could you explain to us how Moroccan citizens are subjected to the same suppression and censorship as Sahrawis in Western Sahara?
The Moroccan state is a highly centralized state. People, government appointees at the most local level are actually centrally appointed from Rabat, effectively. I know this because I was in the Peace Corps in Morocco. My partner was appointed directly from Casablanca, from the Ministry of Youth and Sports, right? He wasn't, you know, from that community. So in Morocco, you have this sort of very highly centralized state. There's two parallel governments. There's the elected government, but then there's the thing we'll call the Makhzen, which is basically a royally appointed string of officials. And its basic whole reason for being is to not only monitor the rest of the government and make sure everything is going according to what the monarchy wants, but also monitor the population. And so you see this across the Arab world where you talk about like muhabarat, so informants, right? And even in the Peace Corps, we were told that effectively, like, if we wanted to get in with our community, we should probably identify who was the street level informant, if you want to call it that, the person who would basically be telling everyone what we were doing in our village, in our town, in our city, things like that. So there is someone at the street level in Morocco who's basically delegated to watch the population. Fast forward to, you know, today, all of this is now jacked up on surveillance technologies. And so part of the dividends of Morocco's joining the Abraham Accords and normalizing relations with Israel in exchange for the United States recognition of Moroccan sovereignty over Western Sahara, Morocco's getting this, you know, plethora of surveillance tools, as well as like high-tech weaponry from Israel. And Morocco's using these surveillance tools against its own populations, against Sahrawi dissidents, you know, in the sort of Cold War with Algeria, things of that sort, right? So we've seen in Morocco a real backsliding in terms of political progress. There doesn't seem to be much of a political opposition anymore from the left or the right at this point. The parties in power are basically technocratic parties that work at the behest of the monarchy. And in reality, it's a country that seems to be run by the security services, the internal and external security services. These are bodies that, you know, their main thing is surveillance. And they are getting really powerful tools to make that possible.
You know, as the son of Salvadoran immigrants, when you say Israeli surveillance, the first thing that comes to mind is Pegasus, because this is a software that has made the headlines in El Salvador with regards to targeting journalists. So that just gives you a snapshot at the very least as to how this sort of spyware or software works with regards to surveilling not only a population, but even journalists as well.
Well, I'll tell you something about Pegasus. The Moroccan king, or someone very close to the Moroccan king, put Pegasus on the phone, the personal phone of the French president.
The current French president. Right?
Yeah, they were spying on the French president. And this is, and of course, this is for Moroccans, this is about Western Sahara. So I know you wanted to talk about issues in Brussels and things like that. And Pegasus is deeply involved in the corruption scandals with Moroccans bribing EU officials as well. But for a period up until last summer, when France did this 180 on its position on Western Sahara, at least legally speaking, Morocco and France were having very tense relations. And that was due to a personal fallout because someone had slipped Pegasus onto Macron's WhatsApp.
Incredible, because that sort of leads me to go back to what Stephen mentioned earlier in his Truthout article, which is this ridiculous characterization of the Polisario Front as a terrorist organization. Now, obviously, both you and I and Stephen don't agree with this characterization of the Polisario Front, but based on this new definition that's been created by this bipartisan resolution in the U.S., it would seem to me like Morocco would be more qualified to fit that characterization as opposed to the Polisario Front. You know, am I wrong in looking at that in that form?
I mean, certainly a repressive regime is certainly violating international norms. You know, there are reports that they have, you know, looked the other way in terms of some extreme Salafist groups that have, you know, engaged in terrorism in Algeria and Europe. But yeah, they're not, you know, in terms of mass killings of people, they're not as bad as the Israelis or the Saudis or the Sudanese factions or anything like that. But they're definitely a nasty lot. And this is despite the reputation that Morocco has in the United States of being moderate, right? I mean, we always hear that adjective every time it appears in the newspaper just about. But you know, if you're being tortured in one of their prisons, you probably wouldn't use that term.
Precisely. Now, Jacob, I wanted to share something that I spoke with Stephen about before we started this conversation. And that is that I had the pleasure of speaking with a Sahrawi dissident several years ago who was in Western Sahara at the time. And what was supposed to have been a 1 hour long conversation ended up extending to 2 hours because of the numerous times that the phone reception or whatever reception we had at the time kept getting cut off. Now, through the magic of radio editing, I managed to bring it down to 1 hour, but it sort of reminded me something that Stephen mentioned the first time we spoke to him several years ago, which is how much of a police state it is over there with regards to media censorship. And I think Stephen mentioned, you know, comparisons to North Korea as far as a media blackout altogether. Now, I want to get your thoughts as well with regards to the media blackout in Western Sahara, because I know that Democracy Now! Even had footage on how they were, in one form or another, being blocked or having some sort of, you know, blockade as they were filming to, you know, bring the story to light.
Yeah, I helped Democracy Now! With some of the historical bits on that documentary. And yeah, they had gotten press credentials through the, at the time there was a climate summit in Marrakesh, and then they took a side trip down to Western Sahara. So good on them. But yeah, no, I mean, I've been there. I've had to do some James Bond type things, you know, putting tape on my door to see if it was, my room was searched while I was out, having to leave hotels at the back door late at night just to try to evade tales from, you know, plainclothes police and things like that so that I could meet human rights activists, things of that sort. Being guided by a cell phone by someone who told me that I was being followed. And so they were like, really? Turn left here, turn right here, you know, things like that. And I typically, whenever I did research there, would take very unconventional transportation. So basically public transportation that, you know, activists who fly in to the airport often get put on the plane on the way, sent right back out, you know. So one of the ways that I've been able to access is just, you know, is by going overland and things of that sort. But yeah, I mean, it's, you look at the Freedom House report, it's usually called Worst of the Worst, where they're talking about the most repressive regimes in the world. So it's, you know, Saudi Arabia, North Korea, and Western Sahara is right up there, you know. for a long time, Freedom House, you know, separated out Western Sahara and said, okay, whatever liberties and limited as they are in Morocco, what you have in Western Sahara is much, much worse. Even if we go back to this question about terrorist states, well, you know, Morocco probably disappeared several hundred Sahrawis during the initial years of occupation. And while Morocco had a kind of commission of inquiry to look at abuses during the Hassan II regime from roughly 1960 to 1999, the one place they didn't look at was Western Sahara. So you have unresolved issues of disappearances in Western Sahara for what was effectively a massive campaign of state terrorism. And today the territory is, yeah, it's one of the most closely watched places in Morocco. You pull out a Sahrawi flag and within 5 minutes, you know, you're now plainclothes cops all over.
I remember looking at Freedom House study just 2 or 3 years ago in terms of political rights. They had Western Sahara second only to Assad's Syria as the worst in the world. And it just underscores just how extreme things are there. And again, this is despite the kind of good reputation Morocco has for a lot of Americans and Europeans, because it's an Arab country that most Westerners have visited. It's just 12 miles across the straits from Europe. And people, oh, Fez, Marrakesh, so Chef Shaoun, you know, is so great. And it is great. I love Morocco. But people really often don't, you know, have a pretty positive connotation. But again, reality is that it's an incredibly repressive country, again, especially in the occupied territories.
Yeah, and I'll admit it right now that I've been to Morocco myself, and it is a lovely country with lovely people. But as is often the case, we have to make the distinction between the people and the government in these cases. And we certainly make that distinction here and in many other stories that we've covered here on the show with regards to Latin America and the Caribbean. And so before we continue this conversation, as I mentioned at the top of the hour, that WPFW is in the middle of its summer place drive. So if you want to continue to hear fantastic guests like Jacob Mundy and Steven Zunis, and to continue to hear stories like the struggle for Sahrawi self-determination in Western Sahara, we need your support for independent journalism during these times. So we encourage everyone to go to WPFWFM.org to make a donation. You can also call 202-588-9739 or 1-800-222-9739. And if you have the Cash App on your phone, make a donation to $WPFWFM. And please give credit to Latino Media Collective when you do so. I mentioned, you know, this challenging interview that I had to do several years ago that kept getting cut off because the guest was in Western Sahara and all the technical issues that one has to deal with as a radio producer. But did that deter me from continuing to cover these stories and continue having guests with regards to Western Sahara? Absolutely not. Because the intent here is to recognize, as my guests today have mentioned in one form or another, is that one of the greatest tools against the Sahrawi people and their struggle for independence is silence, media silence. And that's certainly a case one can argue with regards to corporate media, but in independent media outlets like WPFW, we could bring these stories and these issues to light, but it's only possible with your support. So again, if you want to continue to hear stories about the struggle for Sahrawi self-determination in Western Sahara, please support outlets like WPFW and the Latino Media Collective at this hour. Again, please go to WPFWFM.org. You can also call 202-588-9739 or 1-800-222-9739. And if you have the Cash App on your phone, make a donation to $WPFWFM. And please give credit to the Latino Media Collective when you do so. Steven, I want to go back to your Truth Out article because you mentioned Iran's IRGC sort of as a way to point out the absurdity of this distinction of the Polisario Front or other organizations as a terrorist organization, because if I'm reading you correctly, when you made the comparison with Iran and this particular organization, an organization that you point out, you know, also run colleges and industry and other non-military institutions, the way I read it, it seems like you could be the lunch lady at one of their colleges and still be considered somebody with terrorist ties, quote unquote. Again, it speaks to the absurdity of this characterization of any government, not just the Polisario Front.
I actually remember being at an asylum hearing of an Iranian who is seeking asylum for persecution by the Iranian regime. And the U.S. government was trying to say, well, he was affiliated with this Revolutionary Guard institution. It happened to be a technical college that they were running. And he was just there to learn some basic job skills. Had nothing to do with the Revolutionary Guard. But this is the kind of thing that they do. But, you know, the Revolutionary Guard really has supported extremist groups, including terrorists and that kind of thing. And again, very different than the Polisario. But since we're mentioning in Iran, I got to tell you, one of the things behind this crazy bill to designate the Polisario as a terrorist organization, it's a claim that they have ties with the Islamic Republic and ties with Hezbollah. Oh, it's just total nonsense. So they have nothing to do with it. They are a secular, moderately left nationalist group that governs a predominantly Sunni population. Couldn't be more different than Hezbollah and Iran, but this is the line that Morocco's supporters here in the United States have been pushing.
Yeah, you know what? I had that in my notes for today's conversation, but I wasn't going to bring it up. But yeah, the Washington Examiner did write an article, you know, making this absurd connection between Hezbollah and Western Sahara. And it just struck me, you know, the level of cowardice to think that Western Sahara, which has a population of at least 500,000 people at best, would be a threat to anyone, let alone the United States, let alone to Europe. But again, it speaks volumes to the cowardice of the people who have supported this occupation almost 50 years now running. So we're going to take a break right here. We're speaking with Jacob Mundy, who's an assistant professor of peace and conflict studies at Colgate University in New York, and Stephen Zunis, who's a professor of politics and coordinator of Middle Eastern studies at the University of San Francisco. His recent article in Truth Out is entitled "Bipartisan U.S. Push Tries to Label Democratic African Government as Terrorist," quote unquote. This is the Latino Media Collective here on WPFW 89.3 FM, Washington. We're going to take a quick break right here. Back with more in a minute. Stay tuned. Miriam Hassan, and you're listening to the Latino Media Collective here on WPFW 89.3 FM, Washington. Reminding everyone that we are in the middle of a WPFW Summer Pledge Drive, which gives you the opportunity to support the Latino Media Collective by going to WPFWFM.org to make a donation. And you could also call 202-588-9739 or 1-800-222-9739. And if you have the Cash App on your phone, make a donation to $WPFWFM, and please give credit to the Latino Media Collective when you do so. It is incredibly crucial right now to support independent media outlets at a time of creeping authoritarianism, not just with regards to Western Sahara, which is the subject of our conversation today, but also here in the U.S. with what we saw in Los Angeles last month and what we could be seeing here in Washington, D.C. And again, that is no exaggeration. That is no joke. And so to continue our conversation on Western Sahara, We're joined by Jacob Money, who's an assistant professor of peace and conflict studies at Colgate University in New York, and Stephen Zunis, who's a professor of politics and coordinator of Middle Eastern studies at the University of San Francisco. They are both co-authors of Western Sahara, War, Nationalism, and Conflict Irresolution. So I want to hit upon the subject with regards to colonialism here, because as is often the case with colonialism, there is money to be made in Western Sahara for Morocco. So much so that in late 2022, Morocco's occupation of Western Sahara became the center of a European Parliament bribery scandal. And so I have a clip here of Francesco Bastagli, former UN Special Representative for Western Sahara, speaking to Democracy Now! In late 2022 on this bribery scandal. And he gives us a few details on the mechanisms of this scandal. So let's take a listen.
Morocco has a long tradition of a very aggressive presence, both in terms of bilateral relations with key countries or in international fora such as the UN and the European Union, in support of its agenda. And this indeed has had a tremendous impact on two dimensions that have already been hinted. One, of course, in the sphere of economic and trade relations, and we are talking about the European Union in this particular instance, Morocco has been trying to include the territory of Western Sahara in these agricultural fisheries agreements with the European Union. This is very important because Western Sahara is very rich in, fishing fields of Western Sahara, among the richest in the world. Western Sahara is a major producer of phosphates that are extremely important for the production of fertilizers and so on. So whenever Morocco was signing any trade agreement with the European Union, it was very important that this agreement should include the territory of Western Sahara. And this is where the lobbying effort of the Friends of Morocco became extremely important, so much so that twice the agreements between the European Union and Morocco included the territory and resources of Western Sahara, and twice the European Court nullified, declared these agreements invalid. And yet again, the parliament is reviving an effort to sign a fishery agreement with Morocco, including Western Sahara. So the actually, there's also this attitude of the European Parliament is, to say the least, revealing of a certain extreme strength of Morocco in that forum.
So again, that was Francesco Bastagli, former UN Special Representative for Western Sahara, speaking to Democracy Now! In December of 2022 about this bribery scandal in the European Parliament. So, Jacob, I want your thoughts on both the scandal itself and the resources that he mentioned that are to be exploited in Western Sahara, for those who may not know.
Well, it's not surprising to a certain degree that Morocco resorts to bribery for certain things. When the UN was creating the voters list in Western Sahara for the referendum that has yet to take place in the 1990s, a curious number of UN officials ended up with villas in Marrakech and Agadir and places like that. And later investigations by the UN had to sort of correct some of the numbers in the voter list because it was clear that there'd been basically corrupt UN officials with their finger on the scale. In that sense, the corruption with respect to like trade agreements, I mean, the trade agreements are really important for Morocco, almost not because of the fisheries is very lucrative. The phosphates is important to Morocco, but really more, it's just about the entanglement. You know, if they can get Europe to participate in their economic exploitation of a territory that, you know, the EU courts have repeatedly said, the European Union cannot make deals with Morocco that include Western Sahara because Western Sahara is not a part of Morocco. And they, you know, and so the commission, the EU commission goes back and they reach into agreement with Morocco and it goes back to the court system and it gets struck down again. I mean, this is, you know, absurd at this point. It's just with three or four major landmark cases in the EU court system saying, no, this territory is not Moroccan. But again, that's the point, is the entanglement. It's the complicity. It's Morocco saying, hey, you know, the EU recognizes us as an authority that can do trade deals with Western Sahara. And so you see all sorts of industries in Western Sahara now, you know, green hydrogen sort of things going on, you know, Saudi-backed solar plants, you know, all kinds of stuff that's happening. And probably we'll begin to see, I think, the, you know, the U.S., various bodies within the U.S. government that support, you know, investment are moving forward. And in the lead up to the World Cup in 2030, which would be Spain, Portugal, and Morocco.
That's right.
There's, you know, this is all part of that is like huge infrastructural investments in Morocco or high speed rails built by France, things of that sort. And so, you know, again, even if there won't be any matches in Western Sahara, right, Morocco is going to use the occasion to again signal, hey, you know, Western Sahara, you know, doesn't exist. It's just Moroccan Sahara.
Yeah, I feel like sports washing is an hour-long conversation in and of itself. And for those who follow soccer like I do, I know full well that Morocco for years, not just in recent times, but for almost like 20, 25 years, has tried to get the World Cup in Morocco in one form or another. But now it seems like they have their opportunity in a few years' time. Now, as I said before, in addition to media censorship and silence towards this issue at hand, another problem would be normalization, for lack of a better term. So I'm curious to get your thoughts on Christopher Nolan, the same filmmaker who directed Oppenheimer, filming in Dhaka. I'm curious to get your thoughts on this form of normalization. It may be small, but again, the greatest weapon against Sahrawis is silence, and I would include normalization here in the process.
Yeah, I mean, it's not the first time that filming has happened in Western Sahara going back to the 80s. I think Stephen probably remembers this better, but I think the film Ishtar, which was viewed as like a total disaster, was filmed partially in Western Sahara as well. And so, yeah, I mean, the film has already wrapped. They've completed filming of the Odyssey, Christopher Nolan's Odyssey. So, but I think what was really great was there was a lot of artistic community came together in Spain, in, you know, the US, signed petitions, you know, and so it's out there, you know, people, you know, no, I mean, I think it made The Guardian that, you know, there was this pretty widespread protest against, you know, normalizing Morocco's occupation by, you know, filming in a territory that is non-self-governing, according to the UN, Africa's last colony.
Yeah, and you know what? You just reminded me that we just mentioned the bribery scandal that took place in December of 2022. In November, the month before that same year, FI Sahara, the Western Sahara International Film Festival, actually won an award in Spain for social justice, Spanish Film Award for social justice, a month before this bribery scandal came about. So I just want to point that out before we continue. And before we continue, also want to make mention again that we are in the middle of WPFW's Pledge Drive. And I have to say that one of the most enlightening episodes I've done during the course of this show for the last 19 years has been on Western Sahara. It's also been the subject matter that has gotten the most trolling on Twitter, I have to say, because I never knew until I started doing episodes on Western Sahara that there's this organization called Corcas in Morocco that would troll us on Twitter every time we did an episode on Western Sahara. And we've only done six, but each time they would troll us on Twitter to say that we're Algerian propaganda or all this other sort of nonsense. And it's always shocked me that, you know, gives you an idea, I guess, to the surveillance apparatus. They would extend itself to this little program here on an independent radio station in Washington, D.C. And it's amusing to me. Obviously, Twitter doesn't have the same relevance as it did a few years ago, but it still fascinates me how some people go so far as to, again, silence any conversation to the struggle for Sahrawi independence. And that sort of lends itself to the importance of independent media outlets like WPFW and supporting independent journalism in a time of creeping authoritarianism. So again, we encourage everyone to go to WPFWFM.org to make a donation. You can also call 202-588-9739 or 1-800-222-9739. And if you have the Cash App on your phone, make a donation to $WPFWFM. And please give credit to the Latino Media Collective when you do so. If you want to continue to hear fantastic guests like Jacob Money and Steven Zunas here on the show. Now, we've spoken a lot about the nefarious politics that have been used against the Juarez self-determination, but to discuss the human side of this struggle, can you tell us about the Sahrawi women who largely lead both Sahrawi politics and society? And I have to say that the number of women who have led not only the struggle for self-determination, but have also received international recognition is countless. You know, we can mention Aminatu Haidar, Sultana Haya, Hira Buladi Bad, Nasa Al-Khalidi. You know, I want to also give special mention to Maria Carrion, who's the executive director of FI Sahara, the Western Sahara International Film Festival, which, again, is the same organization that won the Spanish Social Justice Award in film in 2022. So we have to mention here the importance of women in leading the struggle for self-determination and also leading Sahrawi society as a whole.
Yeah, and you could probably name dozens of others, you know, that haven't received international awards, but are just as vital to the struggle. If you look at in the refugee camps during the initial war in Western Sahara from 1975 to 1991, because of the large percentage of the male population that was off fighting in the front, the refugee camps were effectively managed and organized and governed on a day-to-day basis by women's solidarity, working through a system called Tawiza, which like roughly translates into solidarity. And even women demanded training in arms and weapons in case the refugee camps were ever invaded. And so they were able to join the forces of the armed ranks of Polisario as a sort of backup defense force. And so whether codified in terms of law or things of that sort, Polisario's vision for Western Sahara is one in which, you know, women will have a very important role to play in the government, in the society. And it's especially true in the human rights movement, as you mentioned, in the occupied territory, where Aminatou Haidar, Sultana Haya, Jimmy Kalia, all of these figures are just amazing women. You know, been physically beaten, tortured. You know, Haidar was disappeared for several years. The government, yeah, not that they had her detained and things of that sort. And so, yeah, it's just, I mean, it's one of the most important aspects of the story about Western Sahara. And again, it's one of the things that doesn't get talked about because the issue itself doesn't get talked about.
I would quickly add that it's very much part of their culture. The women traditionally leadership role in the roles, and the Polisario have done so. I mean, women keep their maiden names, they have equal rights in divorce, they're unveiled, and in all these leadership positions. And Aminatou Haidar has won the White Livelihood Award, the Russell Train Foundation Civic Courage Award, the Robert F. Kennedy Foundation Human Rights Award, and she's been nominated multiple times for the Nobel Peace Prize. She's been called the Saharan Gandhi. But here we have this other thing, you know, we talk about, hey, why don't those Arabs, aren't those Muslims, you know, have treat women fairly? Why don't they have democracy? Why don't they reject Islamic extremism? You know, why do they engage in terrorism? I mean, here is an Arab nation that, you know, meets all these criteria that the West supposedly wants.
Yes.
But instead, we are supporting this, you know, conservative, autocratic, corrupt monarchy that is suppressing them. And indeed, women political prisoners in the Sahrawi women political prisoners in Moroccan jails are singled out for sexual torture and abuse because they're considered uppity, you know, by Moroccan standards, you know. And yet we have people like Hillary Clinton praising Morocco's record on women's rights, even as this kind of, you know, torture and everything continued.
It's just another reason why we wanted to raise more awareness to this issue at hand. And one of the things that has been important in that is the language, the Spanish language. And I have to admit, it's one of the first things that, you know, got me into this conversation with regards to Western Sahara. One of the things that has captivated me, one of the things that has motivated me to do more shows on Western Sahara. As a matter of fact, Stephen, correct me if I'm wrong, but the Spanish language is even used as graffiti, as a form of resistance in graffiti in Western Sahara towards Moroccan forces over there as well. And it's just another reason why programs like these raise more awareness to the Latino audience here in the United States about what's taking place in Western Sahara. I feel like there's, to a certain degree, a little bit more awareness in Latin America, but for Latinos in the U.S., not so much. And this is so crucial in order to understand this last colony of Africa, correct?
Very much so. The Latin American nations, next to the African nations, have been the primary supporter of the Western Saharan cause. The majority of Latin American countries have recognized the independent state of Western Sahara. And holding on to that Spanish identity, and or at least the linguistic connection, is important. Since the Moroccans are trying to impose French as the second language.
Yes.
And for example, they'll take signs in El Aaiún, you know, what's one of the Moroccans called L'Aaiún, and with the French names on it, and they will write the original Spanish names on them as a means of, you know, challenging, you know, the imposition of Morocco and various aspects of Moroccanization, including the French language.
Yeah, it's almost like a form of gentrification or just whitewashing the very existence of Sahrawi society and history as a whole. And it's happening in real time as we speak. And this, again, lends itself to the importance of independent journalism and independent media outlets like WPFW in order to get these stories out, in order to also see along the way, perhaps parallels to this story, along with other things that are, I would say, unavoidable. You know, and to hit on Stephen's point, yes, there are several countries in Latin America that have recognized Western Sahara. El Salvador used to be one of them, but the current authoritarian president decided to reverse that for a variety of reasons. And so, but I digress there. So again, we are in the middle of WPFW's summer place drive. If you want to continue to hear fantastic stories like these, we need your support for independent media outlets during this time of creeping authoritarianism, because I have to say that it's unavoidable to not make comparisons between Western Sahara and Palestine. You know, there are some parallels and some differences, some very important differences that we probably made during this course's conversation. But since this is unavoidable, Jacob, I want to ask you, you know, is it fair to make those comparisons? Is there more nuance to this than I'm probably giving right now? I mean, one thing is clear at the very least, at least for me, is that there is money to be made through colonialism. And that's one of the main things that I hope people recognize, not only with Western Sahara and Palestine, but with a variety of other issues that we've seen in Latin America as well. And this is one of the things I've tried to do so many times when I've done these stories on Western Sahara, is trying to make the connection of the two as a means to raise more awareness at the very least.
I think the legal level, I think the comparisons are very interesting, especially because we tend to think of Palestine as occupied territory, but not as non-self-governing under the UN system, and the sort of vice versa with Western Sahara. But since Morocco doesn't have any status in Western Sahara, it's not an administering power. In fact, Spain, according, if you talk to any international legal jurist, Spain is still technically the de facto administering power, even though they claim to have, you know, given up that status. You know, I don't know if this is anything that anyone argues, but, you know, it's similar, like maybe the British are actually still should be considered the sovereign power in Palestine, right? Because of the way that they exited the territory so haphazardly. But so what is Morocco's status in Western Sahara? Well, it's an occupying power because it doesn't have the status of colonial power, and it's never sought that. And so if Morocco is an occupying power, which any jurist will say, yeah, obviously, like that's a no-brainer, like it's pretty clear, then a lot of interesting international law sort of follows from that. You know, Stephen's talked about this forever, but I mean, the transfer of Moroccan populations to Western Sahara, even voluntarily, but, you know, again, how dissimilar is that from Israeli settlements in Palestine, especially the West Bank, which are designed to, you know, through human and physical infrastructures to entangle and make it very difficult to resolve the issue. I mean, that's getting back to, you know, the fish, the phosphates in the film, you know, the Odyssey. It's about entrenching, entangling, and making it so hard to separate these things that everyone just kind of throws their hands up and says, well, you know, Palestinian state's not viable, you know, a Western Saharan state's not viable, you know, all these Moroccans, what are you going to do? Send them back, you know, things of that sort, right? But yeah, it's clear that this is an occupied territory. Geneva Conventions apply, it's Oro.
And indeed, at least a couple of General Assembly resolutions and the former Secretary General have used the word occupation, which, of course, is what it is. If you've been there, it's very much a military occupation and a very repressive one. I mean, what Palestine, you know, there are some other partial occupations, you know, obviously Russia with Ukraine, Turkey with Northern Cyprus. But in terms of countries that are, as a result of an occupation, are being denied the right of self-determination, entire nations, Palestine and Western Sahara are the only ones legally recognized as such. I mean, we can say the number of countries have a moral right of self-determination, you know, Tibet, West Papua, you know, Chechnya, any number of other places. But legally speaking, in terms of, you know, foreign belligerent occupation, denying right to self-determination, Western Sahara are the only ones that feat that our entire nation is being occupied and denied that right. And as a result, I think it's really important to link the two, both because the Sahrawis deserve their freedom every bit as much as the Palestinians. But I think if more people in the Palestinian, you know, movement would address the two of them together, it would underscore it would challenge the argument of, oh, why are you singling out Israel? Why are you singling out the world's only Jewish state? And say, no, we are talking about basic human rights, international law, self-determination here. Morocco is an Arab Muslim country. You know, what they're doing is just as wrong as what Israel's doing. And so I think it would actually, rather than weaken the Palestinian movement by taking on another issue, I think it would actually strengthen it and really take it away from a lot of the ideological debates around Zionism or whatever, and then focus on basic human rights and international law.
One thing that I've learned this year alone with regards to the numerous shows that I've done on Palestine this year is that we should not look at colonialism in the past tense. It's in the present tense. It's happening right now. And if we make that recognition of Palestine with regards to Gaza in present time, then we should also do the same for Western Sahara as well. And so with that said, we've been speaking with Jacob Mundy, who's an assistant professor of peace and conflict studies at Colgate University, and Stephen Zunis, who's a professor of politics and coordinator of the Middle Eastern Studies at the University of San Francisco. Stephen's recent article in Truthouts is entitled "Bipartisan U.S. Push Tries to Label Democratic African Government as Terrorist." And we're going to create a link to this article on our Twitter account. In the meantime, Jacob Mundy, Stephen Zunis, it's been an honor and a pleasure once again. Thank you very much for being on the show with us.
Thank you.
Absolutely, you got it. And with that said, that is it for today's show. We want to remind everyone once again that you can support the Latino Media Collective at this hour by going to WPFWFM.org to make a donation. You can also call 202-588-9739 or 1-800-222-9739. And if you have the Cash App on your phone, make a donation to $WPFWFM. And please give credit to the Latino Media Collective when you do so. With that said, that is it for today's show. Thank you very much, everyone, for listening. Adios. Nos vemos. Ciao.
Pacifica Radio. I'm Christina Onnested. President Donald Trump meets with Russia's President Vladimir Putin in Alaska today to discuss ending the war in Ukraine. It's closely eyed by Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky and European allies, who Trump spoke with yesterday. Trump told reporters aboard Air Force One today there's a possibility of the U.S. offering Ukraine security guarantees alongside European powers, but not in the form of NATO, he said. He also said it would be up to Ukrainians to decide whether to concede land to Putin as part of a peace deal. He said, I'm here to get them at a table. The United Nations Human Rights Monitoring Mission in Ukraine reported Thursday civilian casualties have reached a three-year high last month, with 286 people killed, more than 1,300 injured, the highest monthly death toll since May of 2022, and a continued pattern of steadily increasing casualties this year. The first 7 months of 2025, casualties 48% higher than in the same period in 2024. Media reports say Russia's launched more fierce attacks in Ukraine since President Donald Trump took office. California Governor Gavin Newsom is moving ahead with a special election in November to seek voter approval for new congressional maps until 2030 that could eliminate up to 9 Republican House seats held in the state. The Election Rigging Response Act is framed as a counterbalance to President Donald Trump's push to redraw Texas and other states' congressional districts in favor of Republicans to keep their grip in power. Should those maps stay the same, Newsom's bill would preserve California's existing maps. Christopher Martinez has more.
Today is Liberation Day in the state of California.
Governor Gavin Newsom says Trump's call for Texas to redraw its maps made a temporary change necessary.
We can't stand back and watch this democracy disappear district by district all across this country, not just in Texas, but in Missouri, where J.D. Vance went just a week ago, in Indiana, in places like Ohio, in places like Florida. We need to stand up, not just California. Other blue states need to stand up.
Newsom says California is committed to independent redistricting, but given current events, he wants new congressional maps for the upcoming elections until after the 2030 census, when redistricting normally happens. Some good government groups oppose changing California's redistricting process, which took the power from the state legislature and created an independent redistricting commission in 2008. But the group Common Cause has taken a more nuanced position. It says it still opposes partisan gerrymandering, but it also says a blanket condemnation in this moment would amount to a call for unilateral political disarmament in the face of authoritarian efforts. Newsom says a temporary change for the 2026, 2028, and 2030 elections is needed to meet the times.
On November 4th, in California, you have the power to stand up to Trump.
I'm Christopher Martinez.
Washington, D.C. is suing the Trump administration, seeking an emergency restraining order to stop President Trump's takeover of its police department. District of Columbia Attorney General Brian Schwalb filed the lawsuit today after Attorney General Pam Bondi named an emergency police commissioner who heads the DEA with all powers of the police chief. Schwalb says Trump is going beyond his legal power over the nation's capital, and that Bondi's order's unlawful, and they're not legally obligated to follow it. He wants a judge to rule Washington police remain in district hands. Some 1,600 people are assisting in the president's law enforcement operation in Washington, D.C. He cited crime, though it's at a 30-year low. The National Homelessness Law Center, based in D.C., said in a statement Thursday, it's confirmed forces will begin arresting people at 8 federal and 54 local homeless encampments. Video shows a bulldozer destroying an encampment near the Kennedy Center Thursday. David Beatty is a D.C. homeless resident.
I look at it as anti-Christian. I remember the passage of, as you have done unto the least of these, you have done unto me. And the idea that